Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
As longtime listeners and readers know, one of my favorite games of all time is Jordan Mechner's The Last Express. Maybe it's fairer to say that it's one of those games that haunts me, a game of historical melancholy that shattered my admittedly Panglossian view of history as an American kid growing up in the sustained triumphalism of the 1990s. To a less intense degree, his remake of Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, is also marked by a sense of tragic wistfulness. It is a game where the heroes save the day and lose each other in the process, ending with the knowledge that one of them carries a memory that nobody else will ever share, except as a charming and unbelievable story. Jordan Mechner's newly published graphic novel memoir, Replay, Memoir of an Uprooted Family, places these works and Mechner as an historical figure in the games industry in a richer historical context. It tells the story of three generations of his family, the life in Europe that they lost, and the one that Mechner has in various ways spent decades trying to recapture. I'm joined by Duncan Fife, who reviewed Replay for us this week in an absolutely fantastic article I hope you all will read over at remapradio.com. But I also want to discuss the ways that the stories and themes of Mechner's memoir have cropped up again and again throughout his work, retroactively giving some of his oeuvre an autobiographical note. Duncan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And The Last Express is, the older I get, I am sure that is my favorite video game of all time.
I'm glad to hear you say that. I think it's one of those things where, you know, as you sort of allude to, and it's sort of a well-known thing, it broke his finances. It didn't do well for Broderbund Software. But you know, what a sacrifice play. What a thing to lay it all on the line for.
Yeah, absolutely.
So one of the things that I wanted to raise with you is, you know, in these pieces that you write, it's clear you're familiar with the works that are in question. You're sort of focusing on the text of the memoir, but you know the works that we're referring to. And I'm just curious. So, you know, you answered one of my questions right there. How do you feel about The Last Express? But Sands of Time also comes up quite a bit in your piece. And I'm curious just overall. I think longtime readers know that you're someone who was fascinated by the life and career of the Williamses and the history of Sierra. I'm curious if Mechner and his path through the games industry has been a similar interest of yours as a journalist, as a critic.
Yeah, it has. He is a very interesting and I think unusual figure in the games industry. He, like a lot of developers who hit gold in the early to mid 80s, really they come up with something special. In his case, he does the karate game Karateka, followed by Prince of Persia, which are both two hits that he largely produces himself and do very well for him. And so he has it made, really. financially speaking anyway, but he doesn't make a whole lot more games, even to this day. There's a Prince of Persia sequel, there's The Last Express, there's Prince of Persia The Sands of Time, and there's we're now up to six games or five games in a 20-year career.
Yeah. What is there after Sands of Time?
There is an odd remake of Karateka, which is a reimagining, I guess you would say, that I have never played. It looks unusual. I don't know if it's good or not. But that's it. It's a really short. It's a really short body of work. And the two, for my money, the two best games in that, which are the original Prince of Persia and The Last Express, are two, I would say, masterpieces. Two games that really don't have anything to do with one another. I think you can see where Prince of Persia comes from if you play Karateka. I'm going to pronounce this differently every time I mention it.
Karateka is what I've heard the most.
Karateka. You can see where Prince of Persia comes from if you play that. You cannot see where The Last Express comes from. And so that was always interesting to me, the fact that he breaks in such a, you know, undeniable way, really puts a stamp on the action genre, on pioneering, you know, using the language of cinema to in video games, and then just makes a few games. Then he, around the early 2000s, maybe around 2010, he starts putting his journals online, his journals that he kept from when he was a teenager or a late teenager, which was the same time he was making Karateka and Prince of Persia. And those are fascinating reading. And they explain, they're very candid, they're very endearing, they are very dorky, in my opinion. But they explain how he made those games and also, in a roundabout way, why he never made any other games. And one of the reasons for that is at the same time that he is making these games and just killing it, like he is on such a good run. It's all clicking together so well for him. He's meeting the right people. He's catching every break he could, even when he seems not to catch a break. Like Prince of Persia ships first for the Apple II, and the Apple II market has completely cratered at that point. So Prince of Persia is, at first glance, a sales disaster. But it's not, as we know. It does really well, so who cares? He is really, really fixated on wanting to make movies instead of this, wanting to write movies and write like great, like adventure movies or thrillers. And he's trying so hard to break into that industry while he is doing this. In fact, even just procrastinating on Prince of Persia for 6 months or so, not touching it, to try and get his screenplays made. And he's getting like a little bit of traction, but nothing ends up getting made. And what to an outsider should look like the most, this should look black and white to an outsider. He is having such a frustrating experience in the film industry. Not atypical, not, you know, it's not horrible, but like people are saying yes to him, then they're saying no, and it's just nothing goes anywhere. But with games, it's like, yes, we'll take that. Yes, we'll publish that. Yes, it's selling really well. Yes, you can make it all yourself. No gatekeepers, no like flaky collaborators. You can just go and do it, and it's great, and it gets made, and it makes you a very wealthy man. Like, clearly, to an outsider, games are the thing he should be pursuing. But he never quite lets go of movies.
How long was he working on Firebird? The script based on The Last Express, which I will defend The Last Express to anyone. Again, like we're both on the record, it's one of our favorite games of all time. But when I remember for years, it was like, and here's what Jordan Mechner's up to. He's shopping Firebird around Hollywood. And I was thinking, one, I don't think this story translates. Like, it barely, spoilers for The Last Express.
Yeah.
Even in a rotoscoped adventure game, I'm not sure the part where the magical egg that you've been handling throughout the game turns into a giant enchanted mechanical bird that then claws an antagonist to death in the final scene and flies off. I'm not sure that is particularly an amazing ending or is rendered well within The Last Express. I can't imagine a movie based on that on that story ending with the Firebird just going berserk.
Oh, I love it. But, I mean, you're right. There's an attempt to adapt The Last Express for film. There's also, if I remember right, there's like a prequel screenplay, like a film that he tries to get made as a film, like a prequel to The Last Express that, you know, doesn't go anywhere either. And I guess, like, why this is interesting to me, and I think I relate to it a lot, is getting the sense in your career that, like, oh, here's the thing I'm good at. Like, I can,
yeah,
I get a lot of traction here. It's not as hard to do. I don't find it as hard to do. People really respond to the thing I'm doing. I don't want to do that. I want to do this other thing that nobody is giving me good feedback on, that I have no success in. I can't let go of that thing that no one is asking me to do. And not to say that he's a bad screenwriter, you know, he is not, he's just not really a produced screenwriter, so who knows. But the fact that that sticks with him his entire life, seemingly, despite enjoying the levels of success that much more common in the 80s perhaps, but like is so rare for anybody to attain in this industry as like an individual creator, like that inner torment is very relatable and interesting to me.
Yeah, I don't think I'm anywhere near as multi-talented as Jordan Mechner. Like, the realization that effectively one of the cool things about The Last Express is it lets you live the fantasy of being a polymath, traveling through a romantic, idealized Europe. You speak every language. You're conversant and knowledgeable about the world in which you move. And it turns out Jordan Mechner is basically Robert Kath from The Last Express, right? That is very much an author insert into the story. It's a world he wants to inhabit, but he does speak those languages. He does have that experience of, like, on the one hand, you're the ugly American, right? And on the other hand, you are incredibly worldly and cosmopolitan. But the thing I do identify with there, I mean, I wasted a lot of effort in college trying to become a similar sort of person, right? Like, I majored in classics. I did fencing for years. Like, this was a similar sort of, like, I wish to be a gentleman of the old world. And to an extent, I still do. Like, I completely understand the pull. And I remember some years ago, like, I was at a point in my career where, like, as you might expect, there are always signs that Waypoint might not be long for this world. And there was a point where I met with, like, a career counselor to be like, I might need to figure out, like, what should my life be at this point, right? Like, I don't know if this is it. And I don't know if it's gonna sustain me through the rest of my career. And so he has me do this, like, battery of tests that's, like, not an aptitude test, but, like, what are the things that it's meant to, like, what are the things appeal to you? Like, what are various, like, callings, vocations you can do? And I take the test, and we meet later. And he's like, so I've never really gotten results like this. Usually, this test shows people have a direction they are being pulled in strongly more than the others. You are being pulled in every direction at once. He's like, there's like 12 different, like, categories of career and type of job this suggests, and you appear to want to do all of them. And I don't know what to do with that. And I was like, well, yes, that's why I'm here. Thank you. Yes, this is behold the problem. But I get the sense that, like, Mechner's sort of a similar figure where, not only it's one thing to be, like, very talented across a lot of axes, but I think to be genuinely interested in a bunch of things, to be passionate about not one thing, not two things, but 20 things, 100 things. That's very unusual, and it is a gift, but it is also, I think, a a real curse that I think, you know, the talented dilettante, I think, will always struggle with committing to a course that will allow them to, like, achieve excellence in any one field consistently.
Yeah, because there's always something else you can do and do as well as the thing that that ought to be, or seems like it should be, your bread and butter. But at the same time, like, I think there's a period between the Last Express is such like train crash from, you know, commercial perspective, and from, like, his and sort of his personal life, it really derails him. It wipes out all the savings he has from owning Prince of Persia and its sequels. And, like, in another universe, like, that's the end of his game development career. He, you know, he made a big hit, two smaller hits, and then, like, whiffed it away. And then I think maybe he would have stuck to film, because game development would have been close to him, or certainly less appealing. But Ubisoft bringing him in for Sands of Time, and, like, the luck of that team being so good and having such, like, just great ideas for that game, and, like, him being able to bring him in and, like, make him part of that process. Yeah, it could easily have gone a different way, and not that he does much with his in games after Sands of Time either, but in fact, he goes from making Sands of Time the video game to trying to get Sands of Time the movie made with, like, that heat. So I guess...
Well, I think also to that point, I think he's... The funny thing, like, about his movie ambitions is... He's always been a man out of step with his time. I think this is part of it. Like, The Last Express, maybe I hit it too young, because this turned me into, like, I became, like, I was this close to becoming one of those guys, like a Niall Ferguson type, who's like, you know, The Empire wasn't so bad. Like, this close to being sort of that person of, like, ah, the old gaslit world of pre-World War I Europe. Never mind all the dead bodies off stage in Asia and Africa and India. But wasn't it great to, like, be a member of this class at this time? But I think with Mechner, there is sort of he is a romantic in the type that they stopped of the type they stopped making after World War II. Romantics of in that sense, capital R, they do not exist after World War II. Like, they're not really compatible with modernity and postmodernity. And so when I think about, you know, I think The Sands of Time feels like the type of movie he would want to make, maybe even more than The Last Express, because The Sands of Time is a recognizable, you know, 1930s, 1940s studio fantastical blockbuster. You can see the movie that MGM or Warner's would have made out of The Sands of Time. And Mechner doesn't dress it up too much. He loves that same orientalist, romantic, fantastical, technicolor view of the world. And his misfortune, I think, with The Sands of Time is that, I mean, it's a great game. It does succeed magnificently. But the prevailing aesthetic of the time, you see what Ubisoft thought was going to be cooler and more marketable with their follow-ups to The Sands of Time. Emo Prince of Persia. Angrier Prince of Persia. And a similar thing, I think, kind of invades the motion picture they made. Like, it's a similar sort of, like... You know, ooh, he's a bit of a bad boy. It's gritty, it's grimy, and I don't think he, like, that's not the story Mechner wants to tell. That's not the world of his imagination, which is it is lush, it is romantic, it is erudite. Everyone in the Prince of Persia in The Sands of Time sounds wildly educated. As you'd expect, because, you know, it's basically about a prince and a princess going on an adventure together. But it's not totally compatible with what market researchers would decide the people want. And so I think it's no surprise that, like, the movie falls short of his expectations. It also kind of sucks.
Yeah, and you're right. Like, And I think it is specifically the 1930s that I see in his work. Last Express, I think, is a 1930s novel brought to life. Sands of Time is definitely like a 30s, 40s movie. And even the original Prince of Persia, which has no dialogue, it doesn't really have the story, but it has a plot, but it has the structure of a story. That feels like the way in which that is, do you say it in the old school sense, awesome, is in the same way you would feel as a viewer in the 1930s watching like Douglas Fairbanks or someone like that in a turban running around, and the camera is doing these things you've never seen before, and it doesn't matter that it's a white person in brown face, or that there's not really much like literary merit to what you're seeing. It's like, this is a technological wonder, and it does all seem, and you're right, like that's all gone from Prince of Persia immediately. I think he's kind of one of the only people I can think of in games who brings that sort of slight, very cultured, but also kind of guileless romance to what he's doing. And even like The Last Crown, which is the last Prince of Persia game that people love, like there's none of that in there. It's so far gone from that quality that he has that is so particular to him.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a proper trilogy. You know, they turn it into one, but Sands of Time is kind of bottled lightning. Right down to the fact that I think about this a lot too. Like, it's this weird intersection point between him and Patrice Désilets, who you sort of allude to. You pose this thought in your article that, like, should Mechner have just like wised up and been like, I want to be a creative director at Ubisoft and spend his career hanging out there. But I think the arc of like Patrice Désilets is kind of cautionary, because like so many of the, you know, big time great like creative directors of that era end up spinning their wheels for years and years in the system. Patrice Désilets literally can't get away from Ubisoft. He leaves, he waits out his non-compete, his gardening leave. He starts a studio with THQ. THQ goes under and Ubisoft gobble up Désilets studio, and he's right back where he tried to escape. And like there's just a lost period of his career, because it's hard making games and it's hard to escape the big publishers as consolidation is happening. And so you can think like, well, maybe Mechner could have just like cashed out, done his thing at Ubisoft. But so many of the creative leads from that era, we've sort of been waiting for like, what are you going to do next? And for a lot of them, there wasn't a next. And it's kind of ironic, because in some ways, the Sands of Time kind of caused that. Its DNA is the foundation of Assassin's Creed. Like, it is, like, Désilets goes from that to Assassin's Creed, and is like, what if we just opened it up and made a whole game out of the climbing and the wriggling and the squirming of the Prince of Persia? And suddenly that is what Ubisoft is in the business of making. And I can't imagine anything more antithetical to Mechner's narrative and cinematic bent than the open world adventure game.
Yeah, and that's, I don't think I wouldn't necessarily characterize him as like a foolish person, but I think there's certainly like the very safe version of him, which is just like, I have it made here. Ubisoft is a great home for me for the rest of my life. Games has taken me back, and I've like come back with this major hit. They are going to make these games or games like these forever. I could like get a really well-established sinecure here for the rest of my life. And at the same time, what he does do is sell Prince of Persia, like the rights to Ubisoft, which, you know, I think compensates for the losses incurred by The Last Express. So that's like something very financially prudent that he does. But yeah, I think you would not really see him in games after that. And it would not be for lack of trying. There is this, one of the stories that's in his memoir is about him moving to Montpellier in France to work on this open world Prince of Persia game that was never announced. No one knows anything about it. And he works there for about 2 years, and it's sort of like rethought once and then cancelled and then like rethought another time and like then just like definitively cancelled. And that's probably what a lot of his career would have been like had he just, you know, entrenched himself in games. You know what happens to these people. Like, it's very hard to maintain a career in that industry at that level of with that level of authorship and with that like creative freedom as well. Like, it would all go away eventually.
Well, and this is an aside, but like, it takes forever to make games. Like, I think one of the reasons the Williamses are compelling is because like, they churn these out. There's a studio at work, but there's also like rapid evolution of the various artists who are working at Sierra. You can track it, like, you know, how they're both evolving their storytelling and reacting to technology. There's a lot of examples of like, here's the course of an artist. And now like the equivalent, like designers and creative directors, it's like an entire career might be three games. And with thousands of hands touching them, just as a subject for analysis, they are both trickier and also less satisfying because, like, as corporate mass-produced objects, it can be harder to find the person in them. And instead, what you have is like the broader team and then a lot of like market research undergirding it. So Mechner is kind of the singular figure at a singular moment where like being the curious dilettante is also what leads him into games. This is how you end up being someone who makes games rather than like going Ivy League, which is what the, you know, sensible play would have been. Just like stay that course, like go be a doctor or a lawyer or something, just ride the elite ladder as high as you can. One of the things that I really loved about this piece is, you know, as you go through it, kind of what you're also charting is that a lot of the things in Mechner's like most narrative works are just things that happen to his family, or they directly reference things that happened to his family. The scene on the train platform at the end of The Last Express, where it's like, I will see, you know, we will not be parted for long. This war can't go on forever. The fact that Anna Wolf is a Jewish Austrian heroine in the story, discovering that like there's all these resonances in his family history, and in a weird way, these games are, I don't know, way attempts to like vicariously live these moments, recapture them, communicate something about them.
Yeah, I think I said The Last Express. If you look at Prince of Persia, you don't see where The Last Express comes from. You do see it, I think, if you read his contemporaneous journals, because you're getting a sense of his other interests, his interests in history and literature. You really see it in Replay, and I think you certainly see it. There's one of the narratives in Replay is about his father, Francis, and Francis's aunt, Mechner's great aunt, whose name is Lisa Ziegler, and they are Jewish Austrians who are stranded in France for a couple of years in the middle of World War II, unable to escape. And she, Lisa Ziegler, is really, I think, the closest thing this book has to like a romantic figure. Like, everyone else is very human, and even his grandfather, who fights in World War I, is also like a deserter who you know, very in a very human moment is like, no, I don't want to fight here, and like hold off the Russian army and be like the last man standing. I'm not holding the line. I want to run away. And Francis, Mechner's father, who is just like a little boy and has moments of being deceitful or just kind of naive as a little boy does. And Lisa is, you know, not an extraordinary woman, but the things she goes through are extraordinary. She like really takes care of this young nephew who has been dropped in her lap, like while moving around France, like staying away from, like keeping a few steps ahead from the Nazis or just surviving while they are there. And like in the middle of all that, trying to maintain some semblance of an actual normal life for herself and for her nephew. And I definitely see her in The Last Express, even though that's populated with more larger-than-life characters. But Migna's grandfather and his father were both kind of impotent in World War II, because the father is just a kid and his grandfather is, you know, the man of the family, and he's responsible for moving everyone around and getting them out of Austria and getting them to New York, but also kind of, not really through any fault of his own. He bungles it, and he's stuck in Cuba alone for while the rest of his family is scattered around Europe, and he can't really do much about it. And it's really this great aunt Lisa who is you know, the active figure in this. And I The Last Express, did you know, is dedicated to her memory, because she died while they were making that game, as he notes in replay. Mm. And of course he wasn't able to attend the funeral because he was working on The Last Express, as these things so often go.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season 2 of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
The spirit of performance is what defines Acura. And now, it's electric. Introducing the ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
That is a devastating detail. The book seems like it's full of devastating details, honestly. Like, I think there are... You have to go carefully here, because there's always elements of... Again, we are dealing with a very self-aware and romantic author presenting himself. And the self-presentation you sort of outline, it seems like by and large, in the way he's presented his notebooks and everything, he's a pretty honest broker of information. But the portrait he paints is like, I am deeply lost in history. I'm deeply lost in, romantic ideals, and I will pursue those, as far as my family is concerned, to the ends of the earth. It is striking the degree how often you outline somebody in his family or one of his friends being like, I don't get you, man. And it's one thing, like, you sort of outline the fact that his ex-wife, Whitney Hills, sort of emerges as more the antithesis to his character in a lot of ways in the book. But like, we even get lines from his kids about like, why are you always remaking The Last Express? Which is a good question for a creator in their second or third decade of work. Why are you making this game again? That you have all these friends being like, you know, Europe is not necessarily what you think it is. Or, you know that like, life is trying to tell you this is the direction to move. And it sort of seems like his memoir in a lot of ways is like, I hear that and I understand all that. Here's why I can't do it. Here's why I would rather the image I chose for the header of the article is him alone on the beach in Montpellier. And it's a sad image, but also like, it's kind of beautifully sad. Like, have you ever been perfectly unhappy? I feel like Mechner is somebody who like really can savor that.
Yeah. I think sitting alone as the sun goes down, or, you know, in a downpour on the streets of Paris. Like, I think he is certainly attuned to the what is desirable about living in those moments. It is interesting what you mentioned. I think because the book, I think if it has like a thesis, and it's not one that like, and I'm not, this is not a flaw of the book, but it's not necessarily like summed up as a moral or, you know, a lesson. But I think the book advances the idea that the past is important, and if not holding on to the past, understanding it and remembering it and carrying it forward as part of you. And he kind of literalizes that theme in, is a chapter in which the various generations are having Seder at Passover, and that kind of literally talks about that theme. But outside of that, yes, for the bulk of where we find Jordan Mechner in Replay, he is A, making a Prince of Persia game again, and he is excited about it, but I guess no one else is, and ultimately not even Ubisoft is. He is also, he has picked back up a memoir that his grandfather Adolf wrote, which was not published or anything. It's not a book. It's just like,
this is Adolf.
Yes.
The one who kind of botches the flight from Europe.
Correct. So in his later years, he passes away in the 80s. But I guess before that, he writes a memoir of his life, and it's just for his family. And a lot of that memoir is like adapted by Jordan Mechner here. But at the same time that he's adapting it, he's also depicting himself reading this and thinking about it and talking to his father about like the gaps in it, and getting more of his father's story, which is not part of the memoir, and really living in that past. And it's an interesting portrayal. It is tough to talk about with his, because the book also portrays his marriage to another game developer called Whitney Hills, which in the course of the book falls apart, the marriage, and you see the reasons why it would. And it's portrayed as a fairly elemental difference between the two of them, in that Whitney is very ascetic, very forward-looking, doesn't want to be burdened down by the past, wants to not be attached to very much at all, wants to, is, you know, cares about the future and making that sustainable, and giving the future its chance. And Jordan is an old soul who is very much has one foot in the past at all times. And Whitney throughout the book suggests, you know, maybe we literally take some of this stuff and put it in a box and we put it in a closet, or we take it you know, from like all from wherever it is, all around the house, and put it in one place in the house. And he's just kind of a bit confused and lost by that suggestion. And the advice that she gives him about, you know, it's important to not live in the past, it's important to think about the future, it's not bad advice. It's not unhealthy advice, and she's not necessarily wrong to give it to him. At the same time, you see, and I think the book really makes the case for like how little that advice is going to achieve in the specific case of Jordan Mechner, who really just is soaked in the blood of history, to be dramatic. It's not, he doesn't say that she's wrong necessarily. He doesn't say that like, in some ways, maybe his life and things he wants to achieve in his life would be easier were he to stay in LA where he lived with his children and focus on doing interesting things with, you know, the future of game development and game tech and That's not what he does. He wants to live in France. That's very, has this old, old, like generations old appeal to him. And as a consequence of him doing that and like not being able to separate from his like the legacy and the memory of his family and just be his own man who's less attached, he suffers from that, not just because his marriage ends, but because it becomes harder to spend time with his children who live in now a different country from him. And I think a lot about this and the way it's portrayed, because he doesn't ever really refute it or like give himself the argument against her. It's like, no, like this is why it's important and why you're wrong. And he just sort of like takes it in or doesn't take it in. It is said to him, but he clearly took it in because he's repeated it here in the memoir. And at the end of the book, I would say we don't really know what he has learned, or what this experience of getting divorced and trying to balance past and future has taught him exactly. I think maybe it hasn't taught him anything, which is also fine, because I don't know, do people really like change that much? And can you make a memoir of a few years in your life where you like have a Joseph Campbell arc and you emerge a changed person? Like, that doesn't happen to most people.
But it's probably bullshit.
Exactly. And I think he's probably aware of that, for as much as like he loves those mythic tropes in his fiction. I think he is very concerned with the reality of what he's depicting, not least because it's not just his story. This is a story of two generations of his family prior to him, and some of it is really sensitive and emotional. And I read an interview with him recently where he's like, I would have loved actually not to get into so much of my recent personal life, but I felt like I can't do that to my father and my grandfather without also putting myself out there in the same way. And this is what I was going through at the time I was reading this memoir and like reconstructing this, like this is where I was in my life. And I sort of get that from an intellectual level. It does mean you end the book with like, where is this guy at? What is he going to do next? And like, you know, what has he gone through? But I do think that also doesn't entirely matter to you as a reader, because it's not about, the book kind of is not about Jordan Mechner.
But I was thinking about this a bit. It feels like, and probably a wise decision to be like, it's sort of a family biography. But the sense I do get is, for some people, and I don't know, this is, I haven't read the book yet. It looks fantastic. It looks like a beautiful work, and I'm, you know, going to order, you know, the hardcover that just came out. But I can easily imagine someone with different life experiences with the past and with family coming down to a place where like his, you know, ex-wife Whitney ends up, where it's like, sometimes the past is something to be cauterized. Is not something like carrying it with you is not going to bring anything good. Doesn't make you a better person. Doesn't make you a wiser person. It is just, you are just carrying pain and hurt and complication with you all the time. And at a certain point, to be your best self, you need to draw a line under it. I've known people who've had to do that with their families. But I can also very much sympathize. Something that I've spent years coming to terms with is I don't think my family can be understood without understanding something happened in World War II. Like, increasingly, like, it's one of those things that I, like, bits and pieces of stories I heard early, but something that, like, just started to become really apparent as my grandparents passed. Like, as more things were coming into focus, it was like, oh, things that happened in, like, specifically, like, specifically right at the end of World War II, like somebody didn't come home from the war that was really expected was really close to making it, and they didn't. And that becomes like this devastating wound in my grandmother's family that I think you could say devastated her family, completely informed my father's life in ways he didn't fully understand. And then if I were to tell the story of like, who am I, why, like, you know, where do I come from? I think I could tell a version of the story that's independent from all this. But I do think increasingly, like as I look back on it, it's like, oh, there's a lot that like I can draw a through line to the experiences of my grandmother, you know, when she was coming of age during the war. And so I understand where, like, you know, if Mechner is coming, sitting down to write the story, like, explain yourself. Who are you? Why are you this way? I understand how suddenly that story becomes like, okay, so the year is 1914. The place is Vienna. I understand how you get there, because sometimes, like, especially as you get older, you realize, like, oh God, like, these things did inform me. They shaped me, even though there can be an illusion of American life that, you know, it's a nation of immigrants. Like, everybody sort of starts fresh here. Some people don't have that luxury, but also for most people, it's still not true. And you can still be marked by the fact that people in your family came from a place and had an entire life that is over for some reason. In this case, it was, you know, the Holocaust. But that isn't something, like, it does not neatly tie off the plot thread in the history of a family. And it can be something that informs somebody who never knew any of that people or the places or the time where those events happened. They can still completely shape that person. And I think what makes Replay so fascinating is, on the one hand, it's not really about Mechner. On the other hand, it feels like it's about the things that Mechner constantly thinks about.
For sure. And certainly these stories that he would have heard from, you know, the beginning of his life. Like, he has lived with the stuff. Some of it he is only finding out or in the course of the events he depicts in this memoir. But, like, the fundamentals of it, that these were, the Mechners were, prior to World War II, this very cultured, affluent, urbane, like, witty, like, kind of polymath family of artists and performers and musicians. And they were living in the old world and were surrounded by, you know, the glamour of centuries of history. And then all that was ripped away from them, and then some of it is reconstructed in, like, a microcosm in their family's New York apartment that Mechner grows up in, and he grows up with the same kind of urbanity and sense of culture and kind of grandeur of the 19th century European past. That's, like, that's what he is coming up in. He also just happens to, like, get a computer at the same time, yeah, at this very early age, and it's like, well, this has nothing to do with anything, and this is going to, like, take me off like a rocket in this completely different direction. But he remembers, like, he has come from the specific place, and, you know, I am being unfairly psychoanalytical perhaps, but, like, you get why this would have such a hold on him, like, this idea of the past, why Europe is so romantic to him, and why his interests are, you know, involve looking back as much as more than they do, you know, looking forward.
Yeah. And I appreciate that, you know, it is not a, I was worried from some of the things you described in it that it was going to be a an Aaron Sorkin-esque, like, letter to my ex, you know, like he ends up writing in Studio 60, where it's like, here's an entire creative work that's me arguing with someone I lost about why I was right. And it doesn't seem like it's that. And also, I think there's a regrettable tendency in memoirs to, like, impart to a life a narrative arc that life itself rarely possesses. And I kind of appreciate that by the end of this, you're kind of left wondering, like, well, where, what is Mechner gleaned from all this? Where is he going? Well, the nature of a portrait is that it doesn't go anywhere. This is just, it's just a rendering of the person. And you know, what do you see there? What do you take from it? But I am glad that it doesn't end on a, and it all worked out. Boy, am I glad I'm me. You mentioned in the, in your piece that had this guy as a kid seen Before Sunrise, it just would have blown his mind wide open. I couldn't stop thinking about Before Midnight, the final piece of the trilogy, which is like when romance meets the reality of like aging, of not having neat narrative arcs, of just getting older, and a little bit tired of the things and the people and the places that you love. You know, it's an uncomfortable ending to that saga, but it's a very true one. It's part of his greatness, and I kind of admire that this memoir seems like it ends in a similar sort of ambivalent place.
Yeah, and that's another movie, spoilers, that like ends with them talking about what if we had a time machine? Like imagine us going back. Remember how good that was. Imagine us doing all that over again. And so maybe that is, you know, how all these things inevitably wind up. At the same time, he seems very, very happy to be living in France. He seems over the moon, and you know, good for him. Because like, I think in some way he got part of that thing he felt he was missing the whole time, is like life in Paris, although he's not in Paris, but like life in Paris is amazing. It's the, it's like something out of history, so on. And he got it, and it doesn't seem to have disappointed him. He's like, I got that little piece of it. It's not Paris, it's Montpellier, but
also seems beautiful.
Very beautiful. And he just seems thrilled. And I don't, you know, some things about the past you can't get back. You can go to Paris. You can go to France.
And with enough money,
yeah,
you can have all the time you need to read and just like sort of muse on the world. And what the hell? Draw yourself a family memoir.
It is worth saying they do seem like a very wealthy family. And a lot of what Jordan Mechner is able to do in his career is only really possible if you don't have to worry about money that much.
I think that's the one thing that the Max Fisher comparison fails, is Max in Rushmore is a character more like me in a lot of ways, right? Desperately wants to be an upper class gentleman with all like the worldly cosmopolitan training of that class and the experiences. But he's from humble backgrounds. It's all a front. He's somebody who dresses up as a young prep, but is actually very working class. Mechner, you strongly get the sense, was a young prep.
Yeah. Well, he went to Yale, which is where he developed Karateka, while like not going to class, basically. And it's very funny to read in his memoir, like, oh, fuck, I'm fucking it up. I'm not going, like, I really fucked it up my school this year. And, like, it's okay because you know how it ends for him. But, like, boy, if it didn't work out, if the game never went anywhere, he would have had, you don't get the sense, like, his life would have been over. It definitely feels like a Yale education is something that he can afford to be a little bit careless with, or maybe he couldn't.
Yes.
And he's just young, because he was very young. He's, I think, 17 or 18 when he's doing this, and has the advantage of that naivete to drive him to what ends up being success.
Kind of an example of how being liberated from some of the concerns of like working class enables a degree of risk taking and exploration that can open up possibilities that wouldn't otherwise exist. For all that, it seems like, you know, he seems like Cut's a likable figure. The works are charming, you know, that he made throughout his career. And, you know, maybe to my detriment, I maybe overly identify with the character laid out in Replay, where I'm like, yeah, no, you're right. Like, the past was better. To a certain, from a certain point of view, it had things to recommend it. And I can understand wanting to, withdraw from some of that. I think the part that is more complicated is when you read this and it's like, now to be isolated from my family, now to be isolated from my family to pursue this dream. Sorry, son, the past calls. That is the part that's a little hard to identify. Like, I'm very curious if in like 20 years we get a memoir from one of the younger Mechners or something, or like, what would Whitney Hill's take on this whole like chapter of their life together? What would it look like for somebody not Jordan Mechner to tell the story of these years?
Yeah, two things about that. Well, first of all, I don't want to give the impression that he is, his children are like older teenagers or in their early 20s, and I think like not living with him in the first place, so it's not like he's running out on 3-year-olds,
right?
But he is definitely like, he has that, it's like divorced dad thing of like, I'm going to move to France for work, it would be great if all of you came with me, and like, no, we have our lives. And he's like, you know, I don't think he's indifferent. He wants his family there. He wants his kids.
It's Before Sunset, man.
Yeah,
it is. Opening up Before Sunset, where he's like, damn, I wish my children could come and join me in Europe full time. Oh, well.
Yeah. And kind of on Whitney again, kind of apropos of nothing, this was not something I included in the review, but she gets in, or Mechner like allows her to have her own criticism, which is the only criticism that is really leveled at the family, the Mechner family in the book, which is very interesting for two reasons. I think her criticism is only women in the Mechner family are allowed to express anger or able to express anger. I've got that backwards. Men in the Mechner family can choose not to express anger, and it all gets pushed on to the woman to expunge. And so that men are allowed to be sort of like happy dilettantes and carefree because of all the stress and animus and unhappiness is kind of is forced to find an outlet in the Mechner woman. And she tells Jordan this in the book, and he doesn't really say one thing. He doesn't really answer it one way or another. I don't know what to make of it, I do know what to make of it. I don't know what to make of what he thinks of it, because he did put it in the book. It doesn't seem untrue, but it's not really refuted or confirmed either. And it's what you say, like, it is, it's definitely a family that seems of a like mind in a lot of ways. A very close family, like, which is lovely, you know, like they seem like a nice family. It is interesting, like the one glimpse you get of like, what does someone else make of them? Someone else who knows them very well, someone who is married into the family, like what does someone like that make of this, of them? And the little glimpses you get of that are very interesting.
Yeah. Well, and as you allude to in the piece, like we don't, you know, you can't really speculate. We don't know very much about it, but that we don't know very much about this subject is kind of interesting in itself. In Karateka, so much of the materials that you review, the digital clips release of Karateka with all the archival materials, there's so much about the way it was a family project to put that game together. And you keep waiting for like, you see interviews with his dad and them like reminiscing about, you know, that time in their lives. And then like nothing about his mom. And you note in the memoirs a similar sort of absence. And at a certain point, the absence of a major parental figure in the story becomes alarming. It becomes just something you're very curious about, especially when so many of the stories are from the perspective of men in this family living this really like eventful romantic life.
It is, I thought, very odd. Like, he does allude to his mother and his parents' divorce relatively late in life. So, you know, more recently than not. But his mother is almost completely absent from the book in a way that is not discussed. And you know, there may be, there are probably a lot of reasons why that could be the case. And it's hard to speculate, and it doesn't really give you any material to speculate with. But it's very conspicuous, is what I would say.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, it's very odd.
Yeah, it's just it is a striking note in like two works that are very fairly meticulous in the presentation of his documented past, and sort of what you would expect to be a major figure there is sort of left out of the frame. So, you know, as we come to the end here, like, my impression was you feel like all his archival works seem to be worth reading. The notebooks that he had as a kid and a young creator, and then Replay. I'm curious, like, you obviously find them very interesting. I'm curious, like, are they interesting just as a character portrait if you were not somebody who's invested in Jordan Mechner as, again, he's a guy who didn't make that many games. You know, like, there's a handful of us who are like, yeah, Sands of Time and Prince of Persia and The Last Express, that's my jam, that's my stuff. But this isn't Miyamoto, where like generations of like hit games have touched so many people. I am curious, like, this is a lot to learn about one game designer, not a particularly prolific one, from this era. And yet, do you find that like something about the portrait that emerges from the notebooks of this kid and then the memoir of this middle-aged man is interesting or arresting, independent of how invested you are in Last Express or Prince of Persia?
Yeah, I think that's probably the aim of Replay, is to have that kind of appeal, because really, of everything it has something to say about, it has the least by far to say about video games. That he makes video games professionally is kind of incidental to the story in my reading, and it could be swapped in with any number of occupations that he might have. And which is courageous in a way, because he is known for being a game designer, and yet here he is telling you a story about his aunt and his dad. But I think he recognizes, like, that's where the story is. That's what's powerful. And you're not going to interest someone who doesn't care about games in a story about, like, how he cracked the tech for The Last Express. I think you might interest someone in a broad, much broader story about, like, the trauma of the Holocaust and how the irony of watching a story that's told kind of in two pieces. One in which this family of Jews is trying everything to leave Europe alive, and in some cases not succeeding, but some of them do make it out. And then they establish themselves in New York, and the first Mechners who were born on American soil, Jordan, is like, I want to go back to Europe. That sounds cool. Like, I will go right back there. While not being glib or insensitive about what his family, he's very reverential about what his family went through. At the same time, you had the one generation of Mechners for whom America was survival, and then at least Jordan Mechner from the successive generation was like, no, it was all in Europe. We didn't bring that much. We left something behind. The journals, I think, are very interesting. They're much more focused on the nuts and bolts of putting those games together, which is interesting if you're interested in those games. I'm not sure that they're that interesting if you have no context for them. At the same time, one of the most appealing things about those journals to me is how candid he is and how little he censors himself retroactively about his kind of the ways in which he's naive or foolhardy or making the wrong decisions at certain turns. I probably wouldn't give them to someone who doesn't know games to read.
Yeah. No, and I think from that standpoint, I think the Digital Eclipse Chronica release covers a lot of the ground. I think what I find so compelling about that is it's fascinating to realize there's a time in the games industry where you would send off builds on a disc, and it was like book publishing. An editor would basically like play the build and then send you typed up notes and feedback as if you're an author burning through their advance while trying to like arrive at an idea. And all of this effort to basically knock off various Atari hits. It's a fascinating document in so far as however invested you are in Mechner, he documents like in those days of the game industry, you could just mail off your game and as you point out, like receive mentorship and guidance and instruction and advice, and like different world than we inhabit.
The CEO writes back to him and says, like, you know, this isn't really a game, but we thought we see stuff we like. If you have something else to show us, we would be interested in that. Or if, like, here's some ideas about how you could do this. And they'll just, like, correspond for years with, like, no real deal to publish anything. It eventually ends up working out very well for all of them, but it's crazy.
Yeah, it's a bizarre era. Yeah, it seems like a fascinating book. I was really struck by how much it, like, reading your review made things about Sands of Time and Last Express sort of snap into focus. Why his are games that resolutely do not give you the fully triumphant, satisfying, like, and they all lived happily ever after ending. And tends to end more on the, like, what a beautiful memory we have. What a beautiful memory. How sad that we can't live in it.
Yeah, we're not getting that back.
Anyway, thanks for the conversation. Thanks for the review. It was wonderful working on it. I hope people, again, like, read it on remapradio.com. And I hope people check out Replay, which is a fascinating work. Oh, just one last question. Have you read any of his? He's written graphic novels that are like potboilers about like historical, but French language, right? Like
some of them have been translated. I haven't read them.
I'm so curious. Like, again, there are times you just come face to face with like, who is this guy?
Yeah.
Like, he's like, I wrote a comic spy thriller about the American Revolution. And I'm like, Prince of Persia guy wrote a graphic novel spy thriller about the American Revolution. Okay, sure. Why not?
Why not?
Yeah. Anyway, thanks for the conversation. And again, people can read the article on Replay over at remapradio.com. Our music is by Tumelo. You can learn more at tumelo.net. This episode is produced by Michael Hermes. And thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing over at remapradio.com. It helps us pay for articles, pay for producers, pays for us to do a lot of this stuff. So hope you find it cool, and hope it moves you to feel like this is something you'd like to support. Either way, hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be back soon with another episode of Remap Radio.